You are so not traffic on the hour, he says, and to my dismay dabs at his chin with a napkin. Though I wouldn't mind even being that. Reliable, informative, albeit repetitive. At least people actually listen to it. I think your signal is in Morse code, I say with a smile. When I was 8, I taught myself Morse code. The clicks are highly irritating. I lean over, and for no reason I can think of, maybe because I have nothing smart to say, maybe because with David I feel like someone else entirely. I want to be someone else entirely. I take a lick of his ice cream. The vanilla part. He stares at my lips, as shocked as I am. Sorry, I say. I liked your order better. The cold medicine is not for me, just to be clear, he says. Wasn't worried. I wonder what would happen if I looked into a mirror right now. Who would be staring back at me? Did time just leap forward with that single lick? Later, when I'm home in my room working on a problem set, though it's long past time to go to sleep, I receive my very first text from David. David, I am usually anti-text, but I thought I'd make an exception. Me, I'm honored. Why the staunch anti-text stance? David, I have trouble conceptualizing the idea of words traveling like this, and I worry that how they sound to me might sound different to you. I'm not good with tone. Me, I should know to expect a real answer from you, but still, it's surprising. David, when you ask a question, you get an answer. I take my phone and snap a quick selfie. Me in my pajamas, hair in a bun on top of my head, giving him a thumbs up. Far from a pretty picture, but I think it would offend David if I put a filter on it. I press send. Me, is it easier for you if we communicate in pictures? There's a long pause, and I wonder what's happening on the other end of the phone. Did his mom just come into his room asking why he hasn't yet gone to bed? Is he looking at my picture, disgusted by the messy, pudgy girl who keeps overstepping his boundaries? I keep thinking about how I leaned over and licked his ice cream cone, and hate that person, the me of just a couple of hours ago, presumptuous and flirtatious, when I had no intention to be either with David. I didn't realize I could like myself even less than I did this morning. I wait another interminable minute. David. Smiley face. David, that was my very first emoticon, or emoji. Must Google to learn the difference. Me. Finally something I know and you don't. David, there are lots of things you know and I don't. You obviously have a very high social IQ, for example. Me. Thanks, I guess. You obviously have a very high IQ. David, 168 at last check. Me, sometimes I can't tell if you are joking or being serious. Why aren't you sleeping? It's late. David, something else I'm not so good at. Me neither, especially lately. David, what do you do when you can't sleep? I pause. Realize if I were texting with, say, Gabriel during those 2 weeks we went out last year, I'd respond with something casual, a non-answer, maybe an emoji of a lamb to show counting sheep, or a funny gif. There would be no reason at all to stop and think about the truth. Me. Right now? Homework. But usually, I think about the accident and what happened to my dad. David, why would you do that? I stop writing again, look at my fingertips, wonder what they have to say. I seem to act on impulse around David, nothing premeditated. Who licks someone else's ice cream cone? Honesty is not the best policy. Me. Ever press a bruise? David. Of course. Me. Well, it's partially that. I put down my phone and then pick it up again. Me. But it's also like a puzzle. I want to understand when it could have been stopped. If it could have been stopped. What was the very last second someone should have put their foot on the brake? It doesn't matter, really. David. Of course it matters. It's an open loop. I hate open loops. Me. Me too. David. I could help you figure it out if you really want to know. Me. You could? David. Of course I could. It's not rocket science. It's just physics. I pull up the picture of the crushed Volvo on my phone. I force myself to look at it, and my whole body shudders. And then I close my eyes and hit send.
Chapter 11. David. At breakfast, Miney is again wearing her odd duck pajamas. She's sulking because my mom woke her up this morning, even though she is legally an adult and has nowhere she needs to be. The cold medicine I bought is still unopened on the countertop. Something is wrong with Miney, but I'm starting to think it's not congestion. Be careful with the texting. You could put yourself in the friend zone, she says. I don't know what that means. She licked your ice cream cone. That's called flirting. Miney freaked out last night when I told her about that. She kept repeating, no way, no way, over and over again and clapping her hands, to which I had to say, yes way, until she believed me. It was her idea to start texting Kit in the first place, and I have to admit, now that I've started doing it, I'm not sure why I was ever opposed to the idea. I no longer have to suffer through that thick silence while I translate what people are saying into what they mean and then wait again while I process the appropriate thing to say next. Leave it to modern technology to find a brilliant workaround to my social problems. With the obvious exceptions of my parents, Miney, Kit, and Siri, whose hands-free capabilities are helpful when driving, if I could, I would text all the time and never speak out loud again. You want to kiss her, right? What? I have lost track of our conversation. I was thinking about how if Kit called me her friend, then I would have multiplied my number of them by a factor of 2. And then I considered the word flirting, how it sounds like fluttering, which is what butterflies do. Which, of course, looped me back to chaos theory and my realization that I'd like to have more information to provide Kit on the topic. Do you want to kiss her? Miney asks again. Yes, of course I do. Who wouldn't want to kiss Kit? I don't want to kiss Kit, Miney says, doing that thing where she imitates me and how I answer rhetorical questions. Though her intention is to mock rather than to educate, it's actually been a rather informative technique to demonstrate my tendency toward taking people too literally. Mom doesn't want to kiss Kit. I don't know about Dad, but I doubt it. My father doesn't look up. His face is buried in a book about the mating patterns of migratory birds. It's too bad our scholarly interests have never overlapped. Breakfast would be so much more interesting if we could discuss our work. So if you want to kiss Kit, that means you want her to see you like a real guy, Miney says, and points at me with her cup of coffee. She's drinking it black. Maybe there's nothing wrong with Miney. Maybe she's just tired. I am a real guy. How come even my own sister sees me as something not quite human? Something other. I have a penis. And just when I think we've made progress, you go and mention your penis. What? Fact, I have a penis. That makes me a guy. though technically there are some trans people who have penises but self-identify as girls. Please stop saying that word.
What word? Penis?
Yes.
Do you prefer member? Schlong? Wang? Johnson? I ask. Dongle, perhaps?
I would prefer we not discuss your man parts at all.
Wait, should I text Kit immediately and clarify that I do in fact have man parts?
I pick up my phone and start typing.
Dear Kit, just to be clear, I have a penis.
Oh my God, do not text her. Seriously, stop!
Miney puts her coffee down hard. She'll climb over the table and tackle me if she has to.
Ha! Totally got you!
I smile, as proud as I was the other day for my "that's what she said" joke.
Who are you?
Miney asks, but she's grinning too. I'll admit it takes a second. Something about the disconnect between her confused tone and her happy face, and I almost say out loud, "Duh, I'm Little D." Instead, I let her rhetorical question hang, just like I'm supposed to. Day 5, and Kit is again at my table, which means she has sat here with me for an entire week. 5 consecutive days. This makes me elated, a feeling that is as good as it is unfamiliar, especially at school.
So I just want to say something to you, and it's kind of embarrassing, but I think I just need to get it off my chest, Kit says, and I can't help it. I look right at her chest, which is small and round and perfectly proportional. I have imagined what she'd look like without her shirt on, what is hiding there under her bra, which I guesstimate is a size 34B, and it takes effort for me not to think about that right now. Of course, it's disrespectful to think about her breasts when she is sitting directly across from me and trying to tell me something. I'll think about them later, when there's no chance of her knowing about it.
I'm sorry about licking your ice cream cone yesterday. That was sort of, I don't know, inappropriate, she says.
You don't have to be sorry, I say, wondering if this is the equivalent of her taking back her flirting, and a tiny, immature part of me wants to scream out, "No backsies!" I'm happy to share my ice cream with you any time. I look at the food in front of me, my chicken sandwich, a bag of chips, a banana, and wonder if I should offer up something as a gesture. I like sharing food with Kit. It makes me feel like we are in cahoots, an expression that had little meaning to me until recently.
Okay, then, she says.
Okay, I say,
though I have no idea what it is exactly we have just agreed on.
You'll be proud of my lunch. It's exceptionally well balanced.
Kit takes a paper bag from her backpack and presents me with one small cup of Greek yogurt. That's it? I ask, suddenly worried that she is not taking proper care of herself. I preferred it when she was overeating.
No leftovers today?
Nah, we had cereal for dinner last night. It's like my mom has forgotten how to cook or something. Not that she cooked all that much before, you know, before, but now it's like feast or famine in my house. Excessive amounts of takeout or nothing at all.
Do you know how they make Greek yogurt? I ask her.
No, and I don't want to know, she says,
and the smile still on my face gets a little bit bigger. I like that Kit tells me what she does and doesn't want to talk about. It keeps me from going on about stuff she's not interested in, which according to my mom and Miney is one of my biggest problems. I don't always notice when other people do not share my fascinations.
Okay, then, I say, a callback to her earlier use, since that technique is often used in movie banter. We could discuss string theory instead.
Nope, not that either.
We could start on the accident project, I say, because I am eager to help Kit understand what happened to her dad.
I've read all about the 5 stages of grief, and I assume this endeavor means she's already moved past denial.
Not here, not at school.
Okay.
So that history quiz? If you tell me it was easy, I will smack you.
I think about Kit hitting me, and it doesn't sound altogether unpleasant, because it would mean her hand would have to touch my face. We have only touched twice. On Monday, when I helped her stand up in the concession hut, and yesterday, when she linked her arm with mine on Main Street.
It wasn't hard, I say,
and then she does it. She really does it. Kit leans across the table and playfully taps my face with the palm of her hand. One early summer morning when I was 4, my mom took me to the Y to go swimming. Before then, I had refused to get in the pool. Too many kids screaming and splashing and throwing around fluorescent polyethylene foam cylinders. Miney called them noodles, but they were neither edible nor harmless. That day, the pool was deserted, and I was wearing Wonder Wings, which disappointingly bestowed neither the gift of wonder nor of flight, and were tight and unfamiliar. I complained, already imagining the red ridges they would leave behind on my arms, but then my mom held my hand, and we stepped into the water, and I felt that first cold gasp. I somehow got the courage to put my face right into the pool, all the way past my ears, and the world went blue and dimmed and muffled and finally, finally quiet. This is my home, I remember thinking. This, here, where there is room to breathe but no air. This is my home. And that's exactly how it feels when Kit's palm touches my face. Like swimming for the very first time. Like discovering the magic that is water. Like coming home.
Chapter 12. Kit. It turns out clichés are clichés for a reason. They are true. And this one is most definitely true. You never know what you've got till it's gone. Jack and I are in my dad's den, which is half office, half man cave. And it smells like before in here. We are looking for papers. A life insurance policy, information about our mortgage, though I don't even really know what a mortgage is. Bank account passwords. All important stuff Jack claims will likely be found in a single file. My mother, who has clearly reverted back to stage 1, denial, or maybe pre-stage 1, bacon, has taken to her bed stuffed with an array of pig products. She's left us alone to this masochist's exercise. Too many memories in here. On my dad's desk, there's a photo of me at the age of 8, proudly holding up a rainbow lollipop the size of my head at Disney World. One of my dad and me all dressed up at my elementary school's father-daughter dance, which I turned around as soon as we walked in so I didn't have to look at it. Another of just him and my mom on their honeymoon, looking ridiculously young and in love. My mom's arms, still elaborately hennaed from the wedding, thrown around my dad's shoulders on top of a mountain. And last, my favorite picture of my family taken at my mother's 40th birthday party, which is now face down. My dad is holding me on his hip, even though I'm 10, and way too big to be carried, and we're all laughing at a joke he just cracked about my mom getting too old for him. We look happier than anyone deserves to be. Jack and I shouldn't be in here violating this sacred space, but my mom needs our help. When I was little, I used to beg to play in this office, right here on the beige carpet by my dad's feet. I'd promise, cross my fingers, hope to die, not to make any noise, and to let my father do whatever mysterious things he came in here to do. Of course, I never kept my mouth shut. I'd ask inane questions. Did he know that octopus blood is blue? That male seahorses carry their babies? Just because I wanted to hear my dad's voice, I guess. I loved the sound of his voice. Deep and gravelly. The sound of home. Seahorses can carry up to 2,000 babies at a time, though it's usually closer to 1,500. And octopus blood is blue because it has a special protein to make them able to live in extreme temperatures. Now out, kitty cat! This is a no-kids zone, my dad would say, ushering me through the door. I tell myself that it's okay to be in here, that I'm not a kid. Not anymore. And my father's blood, it turns out, was neither blue nor red. It was a coppery brown, the color of dirty pennies. Jack and I work in silence. We have three bags. Keep, donate, trash. Occasionally, one of us will pick something up, like the random silver rabbit my dad used as a paperweight, and ask the other with a wordless shrug where it should go. Keep, I point, more times than I should. It's not lost on me that I have no problem staying quiet in here now. The room seems to demand it. I tear up when I find a file marked Kit. Inside, there are 10 years worth of my report cards kept chronologically. Pictures of my mom and me. The certificate declaring me a National Merit semifinalist. The project I did for Culture Day in kindergarten, where I drew my family holding hands and colored my dad in with a peach crayon, my mother with a brown one, and me half and half, divided straight down the middle. On my forehead, I drew a Christmas tree bindi. The picture became a running joke that my left side is Indian and Sikh, and my right is American and Episcopalian. Get your left side ready, my dad would joke. Mom is taking you to temple tomorrow morning. This file is proof of that which I already knew. Our lives were good, maybe even perfect. And then, in a simple folder, I see a 5-page, single-spaced legal document. I read it. There must be some mistake. This cannot be what I think it is. Jack sees my face and comes to read over my shoulder. Oh, crap, he says. You shouldn't, I mean, I didn't know he even, Kitty Cat, don't read that. My name is not Kitty Cat, I yell, though this is not Jack's fault. It's my dad's. On the top of the page are written the words petition for divorce from the bonds of marriage. I may not officially be a grown-up, may not be able to accurately define the word mortgage, but I am not stupid. I know what it means, and I know what this word means too, found under a section entitled grounds, in underline and bold. Adultery. I run up the stairs two at a time and bang on my mother's door. Mom! I scream and run into her room before she even says to come in. The tears are flowing down my face and I hate myself for it. I've kept it together for 5 weeks, have not let a single person see me cry, and it's this that finally makes me break. Half of my friends have been here. Annie's parents got divorced. Jack is divorced from Katie. Marriages fall apart all the time, but I never thought it would happen to my parents. They seemed above that somehow. And then it hits me that, ironically, there are no real consequences. My dad is dead. I don't have to deal with 2 homes and complicated weekend arrangements and awkward Thanksgiving negotiations. This changes nothing about my future. Still, it changes everything I believed about my past, how I feel about the person I've lost. What the hell? Dad cheated on you and you were getting a divorce? How could I not have known? How could you guys have kept this from me? I wipe my nose on my sleeve. I need to stop crying, but I can't seem to stop the flow of water or the heaving of my shoulders. I shove the papers at her, but she refuses to take them. Kit, it's not what you think. We weren't getting a divorce. We were still talking about things. Your dad and I were going to see someone, a couples therapist, she says, and pats the bed next to her as if she thinks I could sit at a time like this. She is neither surprised nor crying. In fact, she looks almost serene. When did you guys go to a therapist? On Tuesday nights. We didn't really take up bridge. I used to tease my parents about their weekly card game, told them that they should have chosen to play something cool, like poker. And they had humored me, smiled, kissed me on my forehead, said don't stay up too late, on their way out the door. They were actually going to talk to a doctor about my dad sleeping with another woman, get an expert opinion on whether they could save their marriage. So many lies. Last week, I suggested that my mother start playing bridge again. I thought it would be good for her to see her friends. She shook her head mournfully and said, I just couldn't without your father. Bullshit. All bullshit. I didn't know he kept the papers, my mother says. I don't know what would have happened if he hadn't. My mom trails off, and I want to scream it out loud. Died. If he hadn't died, Mom. But I don't. But he cheated on you. How could he? My voice breaks, and I start over. How could he do that to us? Wait. Kit. He didn't. Dad didn't cheat on me. I'm not stupid, Mom. It says so right here. I point again to the sheet of paper which now lies on the floor. I should have listened to the rules and not gone into my dad's den. A no-kids zone. With the snot and the tears and my childish temper tantrum, it's clear to me that I did not, do not, belong in there, even now, even after everything. He didn't cheat on me, she repeats. But, Mom! She sighs. I cheated on him. Her tone reminds me of David's. Flat. Neutral. Matter of fact. Like she's Siri telling me tomorrow's weather. She's not crying, and I think back over the past month to all her tears and wails and the million used tissues she left littered in messy balls around the house. Was that all a show for my benefit? I like to think I was going to tell you. At some point. When you are older, maybe, she says, and shakes her head. Or not. Some mistakes are better kept secret. What? You cheated? When? With who? I ask. And despite myself, I hear her correction in my head. With whom? This is, of course, not what I really want to know. What I want to know is why? And how could you? And what do I do now? That last one in particular. She doesn't answer. Uncle Jack comes up the stairs two at a time and stands in the doorway behind me. Kit, he says. Using the same lion tamer voice he used on my mother just a few nights ago. I see why she stormed out. It's infuriating. This is none of your business, Uncle Jack, I say, and turn back to my mother. I wonder how long I need to wait till she tells me the truth. I will probably have to stand here forever. But it turns out my mom's not even looking at me. She's looking right over my shoulder at Jack, who shakes his head at her just once, so fast I almost miss it. Oh, no, I think. No, no, No! Because now I understand everything. My mom doesn't have to say a single word out loud. Just when I assume things can't get any worse, they do. They always do. It was Jack. My mother had an affair with Uncle Jack.
Chapter 13. David. I am no longer invisible. 83% of the people I have walked by this morning stopped and stared and then whispered to their friends. The other 27% did actual double takes, the kind I've heretofore only seen in cartoons where necks are bendable. I look different. My hair is short and choppy instead of hanging long and in my face. My clothes look more like what the popular guys in school wear. I try not to think about the random fold by my left shin, or that the denim feels tight and bends in all the wrong places. With each step, I miss my old khakis, of which I have three identical pairs that I've rotated on a daily basis for the past 2 years. I can smell my new hair putty, which is coconutty and not altogether unpleasant, so long as I don't dwell on its sticky texture. Miney applied it this morning, using a dose the volume of 2 quarters, and I filmed the process, so I will be able to do it the exact same way once she goes back to school. "Holy crap, little D, I can't believe you didn't let me do this sooner," Miney said this morning, over breakfast, after I came downstairs and, at my mother's insistence, stood still so they could get a look at the new me. "You're going to have the girls eating out of your hand," my mom added. As I walk down the hallway now, I think of all those montage scenes in teen movies where the main character, invariably a girl, tries on a plethora of outrageous dresses and hats, closes and opens dressing room doors in keeping with the music's beat, and then finally emerges, supposedly transformed by something as mundane as a new hairdo and a skimpy dress. What I've never understood is why the boys are always shocked when they get their first glance of their newly made-up date, as if the girls weren't already beautiful despite their penchant for androgynous clothing. Do screenwriters think teenage boys lack all power of imagination? At least for me, the opposite is true. I'm pretty confident I already know what Kit looks like naked. Despite Miney's best efforts, I do not feel transformed. I cannot imagine Kit at the bottom of a staircase looking up at me with a slack jaw, and certainly the thought of anyone eating from my hand like a goat at a petting zoo grosses me out. Is that really a thing? "Wow, smoking, Senor Drucker," Abby says as I walk into AP Spanish. My headphones are on, but my music is off in case I see Kid, who wasn't in the parking lot at 7:57 as I had hoped, and has so far missed our morning classes. This is the second time in my entire high school career that Abby has spoken to me, the first being 4 days ago when I bumped into Jessica and she called me a freak. I don't understand if she's making fun of me, so I just ignore her. Also, I cannot communicate with anyone who wears that much perfume. "He looks like a different person," Willow says. Does she think I can't hear her because of my headphones? Or does she just not care? I mean, dude. I practice her inflection in my head, the way she emphasizes the dude, to run it by Miney later so she can translate. I mean, dude. "Lo siento," Kit says to Senora Rubinstein when she finally slips into class 13 minutes after the bell. "Car problemos." Today, Kit's again wearing that big white button-down shirt, and her hair is pulled up in its Monday messiness, though it's looped into a bagel-shaped bun instead of its usual ponytail. Her face looks puffy, like she woke up only moments ago. I'm 4 seats behind her, so I study the back of her neck.
She has a small round mole at the base of her nape, and it sits right there, primly, like it's the perfect ending to an exquisite sentence. I don't trust myself to remember its exact dimensions later, so I reach for my notebook and start drawing.
I see you've gotten a haircut, Signor Drucker, Signora Rubinstein says in Spanish, apropos of nothing I can decipher, and at first I don't bother looking up. I've just sketched the two swerves of Kit's collar, and I want to get them right.
Signor Drucker, presta attención, Signor Drucker.
See, I say, and lift my head to find the entire class staring at me. I ignore Signora Rubinstein and her tapping foot and all those curious faces and look to Kit to attempt the impossible and read her expression. She raises her right eyebrow approximately 1 millimeter, keeps her lips in a straight, grim line, and then turns back to face the front of the room. Her eyes are bloodshot, like Miney's. Maybe conjunctivitis is going around.
Sí, tengo un corte de cabello.
Señora Rubinstein somehow uses my haircut to transition to her unit on Spanish customs and culture, a clunky and illogical connection, but no one else seems bothered. Kit faces forward, her neck straight, and she doesn't turn around for the rest of class. Clearly, she hates my new hair. Maybe she hates me. I keep drawing. That way, at least I'll have some small part of her to save for later. After class, I end up walking beside Jose, and before I can slip on my headphones, he starts peppering me with questions.
What are you wearing?
He asks. I guess since we're now teammates, he assumes we must adhere to social niceties like chit-chat. I wish I could politely dispel him of this myth.
Clothes.
Where did you get them?
The mall.
Could you be more specific?
Why?
Because I think I should get some. Girls are actually talking about you.
My sister picked them out.
Your sister is hot.
Not sure how that's relevant.
Well, could she pick some clothes out for me?
She could, but I don't think she will.
Don't forget we have the decathlon meeting tomorrow after school.
I don't forget things.
Me neither. Well, obviously I don't remember everything, but almost everything. My earliest memory is from when I was 2 years and 5 months old. What's your earliest memory?
I have to think about it.
Were they expensive?
What?
The clothes.
Define expensive, I say. And then Jose surprises me. Because he does. He defines the word expensive with impressive specificity.
I told myself I could secretly start calling the lunch table ours if we made it to a second week of sharing. And here we are, week 2, day 1.
Muy guapo, Kit says, and points to her own head.
I force myself to make eye contact, but there's too much going on in her pupils. Attempting to unravel it and at the same time hold still makes my processing speed slow down.
Huh?
Your haircut. Muy guapo.
I don't need Miney to translate this one. Muy guapo is, of course, Spanish for very handsome. I'm so glad I didn't take Latin, which I had considered, since it would be helpful if I decided one day to go to medical school.
Thank you. I mean, gracias.
Her pupils seem to be pushing and pulling at once, like a resistance exercise. I give up and look at her clavicle instead, the circular constellation of freckles.
How does it feel? She asks. How does what feel?
She doesn't answer, but motions from the top of her head down to her toes.
I mean, it feels weird having so much less hair, and I miss my old clothes. These are a little stiff. But Miney says it was about time.
and that change is good. I'm not sure if I agree with her on that latter point.
You look so different, Kit says.
Really?
I ask, which is stupid since I already know I look different. What I want to ask is, do you like it? I almost didn't recognize you. You look like a totally different person, not that you looked bad before. I didn't mean that.
I didn't take it that way, I say.
It's just you look good, really good, like totally different. Never mind, I'll stop talking now.
I look up at her again, and our eyes catch, and this time I decide to push through the discomfort and hold on. She smiles, but I'm pretty sure it's a sad smile, because I want her to stop doing it. Her face is all closed up again.
Are you okay? I ask.
Honestly, I don't know, she says. Also, I forgot to pack my lunch.
I push forward two of my small plates, a cookie and an apple, before it hits me. This is the opportunity Miney has been talking about. I should ask Kit to grab some food after school. That would keep up the momentum which Miney claims is necessary if I ever want Kit to press her lips against mine, which I do want very much. Do you care to... I don't get to finish my question. I don't get to say, do you care to go to the diner with me after school? Because Justin hurls himself across the cafeteria and lands in the chair beside Kit. His arrival is like an alien invasion. No, worse, a nuclear bomb.
Holy crap, you scared me, Kit says.
I don't say anything, because I don't like to talk around Justin. Past experience has demonstrated that nothing good can come from that. Not a second later, Gabriel is here too, because the two of them have some strange symbiotic relationship. A sea anemone to a hermit crab. One cannot function without the other.
Nice haircut, Gabriel says, and reaches out his hands toward my head.
I flinch and bend away.
For a second there, I thought you were your sister.
I'm about to say thank you because my sister is universally acknowledged as an attractive person, but then I catch myself. Of course he's not complimenting me. I hear Miney in my head. Remember who you are talking to. Always stop and examine the context. Leave him alone, Kit says, and leans over and grabs my apple. She takes a big bite as if she is proving some point. Maybe that she and I share food sometimes.
What is this? Extreme Makeover Retard Edition?
Justin asks, and then gets an overly enthusiastic high five from Gabriel. You guys are idiots, Kit says, and I don't like how this is going. I don't want her to think of me as the kind of person who needs defending. I am not. After the locker room incident, again irrelevant to present circumstances, my father hung a leather punching bag in our basement and taught me how to box. He said that it was obvious that I was like him, that school would be hard for me, that at some point I was going to be forced to defend myself. Since that day, I've dedicated 14 hours a week to physical exercise and self-defense training, and have dabbled in various martial arts. I know if I had to, I could easily kick both of their asses. I mean that both literally and figuratively. When I studied Kung Fu, I learned how to do a swivel kick and pin my opponent to the ground, face down.
Would you please excuse us? We were having a conversation, I say, turning my attention back to Kit, hoping that what my mother used to tell me when I was little would finally hold true. If you ignore them, they will go away.
Nope. Nothing has changed. Didn't work then. Doesn't work now.
Would you please excuse us?
Justin says, imitating me but in a fake British accent, which makes no sense.
I'm obviously not British. We've gone to school together since kindergarten. In New Jersey.
Go away, guys, Kit says. I really can't deal with your crap today.
Relax, we just wanted to say hey. We miss you, girl, Gabriel says, all smiles, like he and Kit are best friends,
which I don't believe they are, despite the fact that they held hands on at least 8 separate occasions for 2 weeks last year. I've thought about how Kit's hand would feel in mine. I have concluded it would feel like the exact opposite of that fold in my new jeans. A few more words are exchanged. Justin says something to Kit and she says something back, but I'm not listening. I study the back of my water bottle, demote them to background noise. I think back to middle school, all those times I did whatever Justin asked, snapped a teacher's bra, pulled down my own pants, other things I won't mention. In 7th grade, I was flattered by his attention, by the fact that when I was with him, we could make people laugh. I thought we were best friends. I thought a lot of things that weren't true then. I reach for my notebook and put it next to my plate, rub my hands over the cover. I will not open it here, but having Miney's rules set out and nearby helps. Justin and Gabriel are at the top of the do not trust list. That's all I need to remember. Rule number 1, do not engage with people on the DNT list. Rule number 2, do not engage with people on the DNT list. Rule number 3, do not engage with people on the DNT list. Miney put it in there 3 times, rendering it even more important than her latest edict not to talk to a girl about her weight. Finally, Justin pops up as if he is ready to leave our table. I feel something release in my chest, but I should know better. My notable encounters list will tell you that I've never left a conversation with Justin unscathed. He leans down to whisper in my ear, his hand firmly planted on my head.
You may have gotten a haircut, but you're still weird as hell, he says,
his tongue so close to my ear I can feel his wet, disgusting breath. I clench my fists. I want to turn around and punch him right in the face. He has no right to touch me. I know that if I hit him, there will be consequences, as there always are with Justin. Suspension or detention, notes on my permanent record, the kind of stuff that could hurt my chances of getting into a good college. Before Kit joined my lunch table, that's all I could think about. That one day I would get to leave Mapleview and hopefully go to a school where I could start over, where no one knew about my mistakes. And also, there's this. If I were to hit Justin, there's a good chance I'd break his nose. And if I broke his nose, I'd get his blood and skin cells and DNA all over my knuckles. I do not want to have to wash Justin off. Disgusting. I focus instead on Kit. Ignore my instincts and stare directly into her eyes. I talk to her without talking.
Please tell me you know I'm better than them. Pick me. Pick me.
She stares right back, though I have no idea what she's saying. I never know what anyone is saying. It is only later, during AP Physics, that I realize exactly what that eye contact cost me. While I was busy staring at Kit, Justin swiped my notebook.
Chapter 14, Kit. So now everyone knows. David Drucker is hot. Once you look at him, like really look at him, which I did that first time in the bleachers, it's so obvious. You are amazed you haven't noticed it before. Like one of those weird optical illusions that my mom likes to show me on Facebook.
Is that why you've been sitting with him? You knew there was like this freaking hot guy underneath all that hair? Annie asks. She and Violet are so excited by the revelation that is David, they are practically vibrating. We are between periods, standing in our usual spot by my locker. Throngs of kids squeeze past us in the halls. I shake my head. I guess we shouldn't be so surprised, because Lauren Drucker is so stunning it's unfair. But still, David? To be honest, I'm not sure what I think about David's transformation. He now feels somehow less mine, as if he has exposed what was once small and private, a secret we shared, to the rest of school. A haircut, and now Gabriel and Justin are bothering us at lunch. All I want is for everyone to leave us alone. I just think he's interesting, I say. I chose David's table for his silence and for his refuge. I keep going back because it turns out I like being around him, even though I'm not sure exactly why. I guess I'm not being fair about his new look. Good for him that other girls will notice him now, that his world will grow bigger. It's not his fault that I'm desperate to keep mine so small. Interesting, like the Hemsworth brothers are interesting, Violet says. Whatever, he's still weird, though, Annie says. Good weird, I say. And they both look at me like I've lost my mind. And maybe I have, though not about David Drucker. I consider explaining everything to my friends, finally coming clean, telling the whole story of this nightmare from beginning to end. But I can't. There are some words we are not allowed to say out loud. I don't know how to explain that I spent the weekend in my bedroom because my mother and I are no longer on speaking terms, that my mother betrayed my father, had an affair, a word I hate because it sounds so harmless, like she threw a cocktail party, not like she screwed my dad's best friend. I don't know how any of the past 5 weeks actually happened. It still doesn't feel real. I keep repeating it in my mind as if it will eventually make sense. My mother had sex, probably repeatedly, with Jack. When my father found out, he was devastated and was planning to leave her, or us, I don't know. Now he is dead. The first two facts are in no way related to the third, and yet they are commingled forever in my brain and playing continually on repeat. A triple whammy. Maybe I should just say these words out loud. I no longer have two parents. That's the shorthand version. Until recently, I thought I was the exception. I had a happy family. I don't understand what I have left now. I get that I'm being melodramatic. After all, I'm pretty sure Annie's father cheated on her mom, and Annie didn't have a mental breakdown. Her dad moved in with his assistant the same week he left their house, and though Annie's still pissed off about the whole thing, she lets him buy her guilt presents and stays at his new place on alternating weekends. She says the whole arrangement isn't so bad. Is it different when it's the mom who does the cheating? It shouldn't be. And yet, I don't know. I'm so angry at my mother that I found myself punching the wall last night. My knuckles are bruised and red. They don't hurt as much as I wish they would. That seems to be the paradox of grief. There's so much pain, and yet sometimes when I need to feel it, not nearly enough. Has he asked you to prom yet? Annie asks, but I'm too lost in thought to answer. I'm imagining my dad finding out about my mom and Jack. How had that terrible scene played out? And were their tears at the funeral real? Was it grief or guilt? My mother knocked on my door a bunch of times over the weekend and again this morning when I didn't get up on time for school. I ignored her. She texted, too, variations of, "Let me explain. Can we talk? I'm sorry." I wonder if she sent these same texts to my dad before he died. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'd check his phone, but it's gone along with everything else. Pulverized. Or maybe I have the story all wrong. Maybe my mother was psyched to divorce my dad and start a whole new life. No doubt I've learned in the past 5 weeks that my mom has a complicated relationship with the truth. No lie is too big. She'll lie about anything. What? Who? Hello, David Drucker? Prom? Annie repeats. Oh, no, of course not. I'm not going. Violet shoots me a concerned look. I ignore her. She's waiting for me to get with our regularly scheduled program, to return to the land of normal. I don't know how to tell her I'm never coming back. First, you're just, like, bailing on editor-in-chief. And now you're not even going to the prom? Violet asks. I don't answer because it doesn't feel like a question. I know it's been hard and whatever, but you've got to at least try to start having some fun again, Violet says. I shrug because prom doesn't sound like fun to me. It sounds like torture. I want Gabe to ask me, Annie says in a confiding tone, and Violet and I pretend like we didn't know this already, that it hasn't been obvious for months. This is what good friends do. Or maybe not. Maybe I should take a page out of David's book and just say it like it is. Gabriel is a jerk. Annie, you can do better. So much better. Gabriel is the human equivalent of insert generic, almost but not quite popular high school boy here. There is nothing particularly interesting or appealing about him, even when he's rude like he was to David today. He's boring and unoriginal. He gets all his dimension by standing next to Justin, who, albeit also a jerk, is at least a clever one. Why don't you ask him? I decide this sounds like a good alternative, a way to put control back into her hands. If he says no, screw him. Life is short and cruel, and we shouldn't waste a single second of it worrying about stupid things like school dances. Of course, yes, Annie should ask Gabriel to the prom. And I should what? Move out? Never speak to my mother again? Kiss David Drucker? Kill myself? I am not brave enough for any of it. I am only brave enough to sit at a quiet lunch table, to hide in my bedroom, to pretend to my friends for only 10 minutes at a time that everything is, that I am, okay. I don't just want to go with him. I want him to ask me. Duh! Annie says and peers into my locker, as if its dark, woefully under-decorated depths will tell her something. It doesn't matter. I bet he's going to ask Willow. I'm getting a little tired of those girls, Violet says. I'm so over them, Annie says. Kit, they show up at Pizza Palace every day now, and they act like we're not even there, like Justin and Gabriel are only their friends. As she speaks, she somehow conjures them up, and Willow, Jessica, and Abby walk by. They don't say hello, just pick up their hands in a silent, simultaneous wave, like they choreographed it. Annie, Violet, and I used to be in sync like that, I think, but not anymore. Another thing that's my fault. I overheard them talking about David Drucker, Violet says, interrupting my thoughts. Everyone is talking about DD. That's what they're calling him now. DD, Annie says. I don't ask who they are. Again, she works her magic, because suddenly David appears. He walks by, his headphones covering his ears, his eyes fixed straight ahead, and he doesn't see us. He's obviously off in his own world, so I can get a good look at him without getting caught. His hoodie pulls across his broad shoulders, and he's muscly under there. He smells good, too. David's lemony. Fresh. Sweet. Is that an outline of a six-pack? I ask. Never noticed that before, Violet says. Yum, Annie adds after he passes.